This morning on Northland Morning is another one of those mornings where you really wish that you were doing television instead of radio. The book is called A Bag Worth a Pony by Marcia G. Anderson, and Marcia joins us on the phone this morning to tell us some more about this absolutely gorgeous book. Marcia, good morning, and thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
The book is about the art of the Ojibwe bandolier bag. And if you're not quite sure what a bandolier bag looks like, well, for one thing, of course, we'll have the book cover up on our website, and you'll be able to see it, and you'll know instantly what you're talking about. But can you kind of just describe the bag itself before we get into the really magical part, Marcia?
Well, they're extraordinarily large, and they're worn across the chest. So from, say, your left shoulder, the strap would cross your chest, and the pocket itself would rest on your right hip. So that's how they're worn, kind of like a really large purse, I guess, if, you know, you wear your bag that way. But the strap is quite a bit wider, and it's all decorated and intended to make an impression, and it certainly does. If you were dancing on the powwow grounds, you could be seen from quite a distance.
Now, was the purpose of the bag as part of regalia, or was the purpose of the bag to carry stuff in it?
Well, that's the first question everybody asked me that I still don't have an answer for after 35 years. Not sure exactly how they originated, but they seem to have always had more of a role of stature, visibility, than actual functionality as what we would call a bag. Certainly people carried things in them occasionally, but they were much more about visibility and certainly, as you said, part of regalia.
Well, and if you're dancing with one of these beautiful bags, it isn't going to really have that incredible motion, and you mentioned this a number of times in the book, and you've got some photographs. It isn't going to have the same kind of motion that a piece of regalia would if it's, you know, for example, stuffed full of, you know, the sorts of things that we stuff in our bags,
yeah,
you know,
you're right.
Nonsense
you're right.
And sales receipts and that kind of thing. And of course,
Go ahead. No.
I was just going to say many of them are decorated on the bottom, of course, too, with fringe and with various kinds of, you know, ornamentation that's going to lend that sense of movement also to them.
Right, and I think, of course, you know, my favorite historic photograph is on the cover of the book, and it's from 1900 at White Earth, and there's very few historic photographs showing the bags, what I call being danced or moving. And there is something magical about that that happens when they are being danced. I think of the pocket itself as sort of a small artist painter's palette in terms of a blank field to be filled with whatever you're interested in.
One of the points that you made that is not only fascinating, but as you read it, you kind of get this little thump inside and you stop and you think. It's a very simple statement, and it's not meant to put anybody on the defensive, for heaven's sake. It's just meant for you to think about and internalize that at the time that these bags were being made and folks were perhaps writing about them, the white European men that were writing much of the history didn't put a lot of value on Native American stuff, and they certainly didn't put a lot of value on women's work. And when you try to take that idea and run with it, you realize, wow, there could be a lot of things missing from our history.
Yeah, I've often thought of history as a jigsaw, 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle with about 600 pieces missing. really, you're right. It's a very challenging to think that all of these wonderful pieces of material culture have survived, but their stories are lost to us. And the early ethnographers were primarily men. It wasn't until the late 1890s that women ethnographers started to talk about objects, and they were the first ones that were really interested in the work of women. And at that time, it was always women who were doing the bandolier bag.
And you were a brand new employee at the Minnesota Historical Society when you opened a box and found basically just a tangle of these beautiful bandolier bags at
right.
one point. And that's kind of, it sounds like that's kind of what sparked your interest. What was that moment like?
I was unpacking 250,000 objects, and this was only 150 of those. But that's a lot of one kind of thing to have survived. And the fact that they were all so beautiful said to me that they survived for a reason, and I needed to find out what that was.
Well, they truly are exquisite. And if you are, you know, I had mentioned to you, I said that I do needlework myself. And so the book was fascinating and the photographs were absolutely fascinating. And you said that that's one of the cool things about the book is that it can appeal to people, a lot of different people, in a lot of different ways.
I agree. I agree. And I think what I think you, if you look at the book, one of the sections that is the most interesting issues or questions for me is that the way the Ojibwe women bead artists arranged all these kinds of images of leaves and flowers and berries and vines in different sizes and different colors and different varieties of plants on the same vine, to me, is a sort of unique technique, a unique floral technique of beadwork that is theirs alone. And it is magical.
And you mentioned that You mentioned at the beginning of the book, as in the introduction to the book, that it was the Ojibwe, the Northern Minnesota Ojibwe, that really pioneered these bags, and that this was really where you found the most of this kind of artwork and the best of this kind of artwork.
Well, they didn't pioneer them because they were another form of them existed earlier on the East Coast, but the kind that we're familiar with in the Great Lakes region. Where they were most productive in terms of numbers made. I do think the Ojibwe of Minnesota are the ones that really sort of at the top of the bead artist heap. They really produce a lot, and their work is extraordinary.
And then you interview a number of folks. Pretty much the second half of the book is interviews with practitioners of this beautiful art from the different Ojibwe reservations in our area. And I really wanted you to read a little section from one of these interviews. Marcy McIntyre is a bead artist, and she is working, you know, she is working currently now. She is from Grand Portage. And I was really interested in what she had to say. Again, it was sort of a thing that someone expresses how they really feel, and you try to kind of internalize that and say, okay, well, how does that change and impact things, and how will I look at things differently having gained this insight from reading it? Would you share Marcy's words here from this interview that you did with her, please?
Sure. The most important part of the book for me is the voices of the bead artists and the Ojibwe people whose stories this are. So this is the last paragraph of Marcy's essay. Beadwork is an art which has proven to be a satisfying and fulfilling experience for me. I receive a great deal of pride and enjoyment from my work. Beadwork is an aspect of my life which makes me extremely happy. Happiness contributes to an individual's sense of self-esteem and feeling of self-worth. Self-esteem is especially important for a woman living in a predominantly patriarchal society. I believe the art of beadwork has given me permission to function as an autonomous individual. My art has given me the freedom to feel integrated and whole. When I am doing beadwork, I feel like I've been freed from the dehumanizing effects of sexism and racism, creating a much more satisfying life. The happiness derived from creating art provides meaning for life. For me, it is the ultimate reality, providing the greatest sense of peacefulness an individual can experience.
There's so much there in that paragraph about the importance of self-esteem and the importance of finding something that you tap into that not only you find valuable, but that seems to find you valuable. And then also for her to have found something that takes her away from the things in her everyday life that would be dragging her down, perhaps, and putting her in this peaceful, whole, integrated place. And most people struggle for years to try to find something like that.
True, true.
It is an astonishing book, Marcia. It is a wonderful, wonderful book. And even if you pick it up at some point and just looking at all of the pictures, if you are a hand worker, you're going to be fascinated in the stories and in the designs. And you might be, like I confess to you, plotting, how could I maybe translate this into a needlework design? There is, by the way, also some scrumptious needlework in this book also. That's not really the focus of the book, but I did find some beautiful embroidery work, and it's just a fascinating story about culture and about history and about the parts of history that are missing and how you find some of those missing pieces. And it's a real treat, Marcia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much, Lisa.
Marcia Anderson, the author of a book called A Bag Worth a Pony, our guest this morning on Minnesota Reads. Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.